fight for this title. And he's got to go to Middlesbrough and get something. And I'll tell you, honestly, I will love it if we beat them.
Yes, everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Warm Down. I've got another author with us today, and I'm delighted to be joined by Kieran Maguire, a.k.a. The Price of Football. Very interesting Twitter account to follow, especially if you're involved or wanting to be involved in football finances. And we've got a range of topics that we're going to discuss today, from Glazer ownership, the transfer market potentially changing amid the pandemic. We'll talk about different sponsorships, maybe even touch on Mike Ashley and the Saudis, and wherever else it goes. Kieran, how are you doing, mate?
I'm sound. I'm staying indoors. Luckily, I've got a dog who's my get out of jail free card, because I can go walking him.
Literally,
as far as I want. Yes, yeah. No neighbours, but you know, no neighbours dibbing me in or anything like that.
Right. So let's the two big things that we need to talk about is one, is the transfer market about to collapse amid the pandemic, and two, are United in trouble because of the Glazer debt and our ability to repay that?
Okay, well, let's look at those in turn. First of all, in terms of the transfer market, what we're going to see is a collapse in prices. So for those clubs that have got big outstanding instalments due, they're stuffed with those. Mm-hmm. I think for a club such as United, which traditionally is a buying club rather than a selling club, they're actually in a fairly strong position. The nature of the players they've been associated with, you're going to be able to not just shave a bit off the price, you'll be able to put down a much lower offer. And depending upon the financial circumstances of that individual club, they might have to accept you first off. If you go back to what happened with United and Harry Maguire last summer, the first time United went in, Leicester said no. The second time, they said no. And they just kept knocking them back until United had to agree £80 million, 100% cash up front. I don't think selling clubs will be in the position to reject United to the same extent that they have done in previous seasons. So, and it's not just United, it's any club who's got a strong balance sheet or has wealthy owners. So therefore, City, they're going to be in a strong position. Yeah. PSG, the same. I think the two big Spanish clubs will not be very strong, because they're a bit more precarious. Barcelona's got a lot of debt. In the rest of the Premier League, the majority of the clubs are going to be very, very cautious this summer.
The thing about the deals up front and stuff like that, there's a rumour going round that Jack Grealish is probably going to be one of United's targets this summer. The rumour that's going round was United was given the option of, if you want to pay in instalments, it's going to cost you £80 million, and that'll probably be over something like 3 years. Or if you give us 50-55 up front, take him away. Is that the sort of deal that, or the sort of negotiation tactic you think people are going to be using this summer?
I think very much so, depending upon who you're buying from. I think the one thing that Villa have got going in their favour is that because they are owned by two multi-billionaires, they do have the resources to simply turn around and say, well, we're not desperate for the cash because the owners will stick in another 20 or 30 million to see us over the next few months. Whereas if you are looking, if you're looking to sign, say, McNeil from Burnley, and I appreciate he's not probably a player United's sights, you would be able to get a discount from them, because their owners are not in the same degree of wealth as those of Villa.
Why are United in a strong position? Because on the face of things, I see a club which is still lumped with 80-90% of its capital debt from the takeover 15 years ago. We've paid around about £1 billion back in interest and refinancing payments. And we owe somewhere in the region, although I believe that's being paid off, of around £200 million. For transfers that have happened in recent years. So how are United in a strong position?
Well, in terms of the debt, what the Glazers have done is that they've managed to get, first of all, the interest rate down. You know, in those crazy days of 2010 and 11, when they were paying 16.25% interest on PAK loans, and the interest was rolling up on the interest. You know, those days, fortunately for United, have gone. When they had the share issue, they paid down a bit of the debt. So the debt isn't due to be repaid for many years. So therefore, you've only got the interest on that. And that's costing United around about £20 million a year. Now, it's, you know, £20 million is still a phenomenal amount of money, but for a club of United stature, it's something which they can easily bear. So as far as the debt is concerned, because they don't have to because effectively it's an interest-only loan, and what will happen is that the next time it's due to be repaid, they'll just go to the banks and they'll just kick it down another 10 years because the banks are quite happy to pick up the interest on a yearly basis. You know, United is gold standard as far as Premier League clubs are concerned. They're never going to be relegated. They're regularly playing in Europe. They've got all of the... you know, benefits of the commercial deals, you know, which, like them or lump them, do bring in money for the club.
So we're looking at United essentially pay just the interest, and then there's no call for the capital payment to be brought down any, and potentially it could be something that's passed on to the next owner or involved in the negotiation if we was ever to be bought out.
Yeah, so what would happen automatically is because of the nature of the loans, they have something which is referred to as a change of control clause, which means in theory, if you owe money to, let's say, JP Morgan or you owe money to Goldman Sachs, is that if the owners change, the loans have to be repaid. But what they would normally do is they'd look to see the new owners and they'd just transfer the name across. So I don't see a huge problem in terms of that debt. So you're absolutely right that United owed an awful lot of money to the banks. They owed at the end of June 2018, they owed $188 million to other clubs for transfers, but they had $300 million in the bank. So what they've done is during the second half of 2019 is that the money they've got in the bank has gone down, as has the money they owe to other football clubs, because they've been paying down a lot of those instalments. So that the two things have gone down hand in hand.
So you think United have got some cash in the bank then to go mad with or to potentially take advantage of this summer?
Yeah, I mean, they had $100 million in the bank at the end of December. Clearly, you know, they've got a big wage bill. The wage bill is about $25 million a month. But this is Manchester United we're talking about. You know, this is a club that's got $275 million a year coming in from sponsors. Now, some of those sponsors might not be able to pay. They might not want to renew if they're up for renewal in 2020 because they've got cash problems themselves and they can't go to their employees and say, hey, we've just signed a $10 million pound sponsorship deal with Manchester United when they're laying off staff and things of that nature. So it's going to be a tough market, but United, I think, are in a stronger position than most clubs to fight it off. In terms of match day, I think what United have done, you've got to give them credit for, you know, and I appreciate it's normally the norm is to give the boardroom a load of stick.
The rule.
But in terms of either offering rebates or discounts off next year's season ticket, if matches don't take place, then I think that does show a degree of at least acknowledging that you know, the fan base have got cash flow problems and financial issues arising as well.
Well, supposedly, this is a bit of an information for anybody watching as well, season tickets now don't have a deadline. The deadline was 10 days away. It was 1st of May. So the deadline was literally 1st of May for next year's season tickets. There is now no deadline. I don't know how long that's going to last for, obviously. But it's going to be very interesting to see what happens. There's, like, as you mentioned, there's potentially rebate. Well, technically, there probably will be a rebate on the current year's season ticket because we've missed, well, United had potentially 18 games left if we'd have gone the distance in all the competitions. So there's probably some, at least 8 games, I would have thought, to rebate for this year. Whether that just gets knocked off next year's, that's a decision for someone at the club. I think United have handled the pandemic very well, actually. And they're doing a lot of stuff which is just very positive, the way the club's responding to the community. They've used this time to finalise, formalise and announce the 1,000 youth season tickets for the singing section, which is really good. They obviously didn't furlough staff. It doesn't sound like the players have had a wage cut either, that I'm aware of. Have you heard any different?
I've not heard any different. If you take a look at Manchester United under the Glazers, yeah, they paid $700 million for it. If they sold it today, they could sell it for $2 to $2.5 billion. So you know, they've done very well out of it. So therefore, it does seem churlish if they then approach the players to say, well, you're millionaires, bail out us as billionaires. And I think United are in a strong position. Harry Maguire, I think he's conducted himself very well as the captain and as effectively, I think he's the PFA rep as well. If they end up having to defer some wages, I don't think the players would have a huge... I don't think they kick off about that. They're not stupid. They know that the clubs need cash coming in to pay the cash going out. A lot will depend on how long it is before we resume football. And I think there's two issues. First of all, matches taking place, which will probably happen at some point over the summer. And then there's matches taking place in front of a paying audience. And realistically, that's not going to happen before 2021.
I know. It's so hard to even imagine that that's the case. But I think it probably is the case, isn't it? I think potentially amateur sport might come back because you're talking, you know, a couple of dozen people tops, but I think concerts and football stadiums, at least in the top flight, they can't come back prior to a vaccine. It's just irresponsible, isn't it? Do you think there'll be a case where you have to prove you've had a vaccine before you can go to the game, do you reckon?
There'll be something of that nature. We've all got smartphones these days. You'll have an app which will give you evidence, and then effectively, as well as having to go and show your season card, you'd have to go and flash your app, which will go through a sensor as well to show that you're vaccinated out.
Oh, mate, the tinfoil hat brigade are going to lose their minds at that, aren't they? Oh, my God. The ones that don't like... Right, you made a really good comment on the Glazer podcast that you did back in October, and if you've not, I'll bang a link to that podcast in the description. It's a really interesting podcast that's worth listening. Actually, I haven't read your book yet. I get loads of different books, and I go, "Oh, I'd like to read that." But I do that like three times a day, and I've now just got a pile as tall as me of books I haven't read yet. And yours is in that pile. I think I got it about 6 months ago. So I haven't read the book yet, but I believe it's very good. I've read the reviews. But on your podcast, you mentioned that you don't think that the Premier League is a financial juggernaut.
No, the majority of the clubs in the Premier League actually lose money. I've been doing some numbers this morning working on a slightly different project, and they lost around about £350 million between them, the 20 clubs. Now, within that, you've got Spurs, who are the biggest profit makers. United were second. And then you've only got about another four or five, and some of them are just about breaking even. And at the other end of the scale is Chelsea and Everton, losing in excess of £100 million a year. Now, what can you do in respect of those losses? Well, you can either sell players, which is, you know, as we've just discussed, if the backside falls out of the transfer market, you're going to have a problem flogging the players and getting decent prices for them, or you're relying on owners. And in the case of both Chelsea and Everton, of course, they're being bailed out by Abramovich and Mashiri and whoever's behind Mashiri. And I don't think it would take a long time to guess who's behind him.
But you mentioned, just in terms of the league as itself, people assume that it's a massive money-making thing, but it's a smaller company or a collection of companies than say, Bet365 alone.
Oh, absolutely. If you look at the total turnover of all the clubs in the Premier League, that comes to £5 billion. Now, Bet365 took £65 billion in bets last year. So I think we fall into this trap of thinking that football's a big industry. It's an industry with a big voice, you know, because it's on the back pages, because we live and breathe. You know, you live and breathe United, so therefore you want information about them 24/7. And I think we fall into the trap is that, you know, Manchester United's got a turnover of £600 million. Well, that's not significant. You know, you just got, you say, I mentioned Bet365. You look at electrical companies, look at car manufacturers and so on. And also, football is a really dumb business, because in which other industries are you open 30 days a year?
Yeah, that's open 30 days a year at your physical site. They are open with their own media channels and their online shops. They are online and selling 24/7 still.
Manchester United are. You drop down to, you know, if you're Walsall, if you're Morecambe, there's nobody walking into your megastore on a daily basis. You might get two or three punters if you're lucky. I think United are unique, or they are one of the uber clubs which transcend football. Manchester United transcends football in the same way that Tiger Woods does golf and Roger Federer does in terms of tennis, and they get the benefits from that. You've only got, even if you drop down into the mid-tier clubs, if you take a small club such as, you know, say Crystal Palace, they don't have money coming in 7 days a week because of the nature of the business. They try to do a bit of hospitality and this, that and the other, but compared to United and Liverpool and Chelsea and City and so on, they're just simply not in the same ballpark. We're talking commercial income levels of perhaps £10 million a year compared to United's 275.
Are we going to see clubs go bump because of this pandemic?
Premier League, probably not, because I suspect that what will happen is matches take place behind closed doors. And on the back of that, the broadcasters say, well, we want every match to broadcast, not just the ones we've signed up for. And the Premier League will say, we'll give you whatever you want.
Of course.
Yeah. As season ticket holders, they've got your email address. You'll get a voucher. You'll get a code. You'll be able to watch all United's home games via TV. So I think that the Premier League clubs will be fine. As we start to drop down the divisions, where clubs become more and more reliant upon turnstiles clicking, you've got a far bigger problem.
Yeah, I'm thinking there's probably some Championship or League One clubs that gambled on promotion that are now well in the shit. What's the sort of split between match day, commercial and other revenue as you start moving away from the Premier League?
Well, in the Premier League, it's 60% broadcast, 27% commercial, 13% is match day, and that can be as low as 4% for the likes of Bournemouth and Burnley.
Wow.
Yeah, but as you go into the Championship, the match day becomes around about 30%. It's as high as 40 for those clubs that have been in the Championship and for donkey's years and aren't getting parachute payments. And it's around about that 40% level in Leagues 1 and League 2. So, you know, how they need us to turn up, because it's not just the match day ticket, because you do get you get your catering, you buy a programme. You know, if you're supporting Accrington or Morecambe or God bless them when they used to exist, even Bury, you know, they did rely on that money coming in on a week-by-week basis. Those clubs are likely to have furloughed their staff, but of course, as soon as the EFL give the green light, and the EFL have effectively said that matches are going to take place behind closed doors, you saw the letter from Rick Parry the other day, there's still going to be a big issue, because the money that those lower league clubs have got in the last few weeks, it isn't new money. It's simply an advance of money they would have normally got at the end of May.
Right.
It's just buying time.
Yeah. When it comes to the argument in terms of continue playing or start the season again, I understand the desire to want to finish the season. I also fully understand the desire to draw a line under it, because, you know, 30th of June then is the contract renewal day. It's the technical start of the new season the following day, all of those things. I think it needs to come from UEFA down, because if the Premier League decides, fuck it, we're going to October, what happens with the transfer window? What happens with qualifications for European competitions? Because that's not going to be decided till October, when those competitions technically have started. What's the argument for clubs saying this is going to finish us one way or another? Surely the no games being played shouldn't matter which season it's in, or am I getting the stick wrong here?
Well, we've seen in Scotland they've effectively liquidated the bottom three divisions in terms of matches for this year. And that's because the money involved, you know, most of the clubs in Scotland in those lower leagues are part-time anyway. And the rewards for being promoted are low. The problem we're going to have here in England is that if we say 2019-20 has finished, we're just going to effectively write off the season, you're going to have Radrizzani at Leeds saying, well, hold on, I budgeted for promotion this year. I went in all in. I'm playing Bielsa $3 million a year. I'm going to sue the arse off the Premier League and the EFL because, you know, and whether you loathe Leeds as a United fan, they are the best team in the Championship by far this season, and on a football basis, they thoroughly deserve to go up. So to take that away from them is unfair. So what are they going to do? First thing they're going to do is they're going to pop along to their friendly lawyer, and he's going to put in a lawsuit for loss of income, because the step-ups from championship, from League One to Championship, you're going from £1 million to £7 million. Yeah, so yeah, a factor of seven in TV money, and you're going to got that factor of seven again between the Championship at £7 to £8 million, and all of a sudden Premier League, even if you're at the arse end of the division, you're still picking up £100 million in broadcast money. Plus, of course, you've got the new sponsorship deals and shirt deals, and you know the hospitality packages are coming in at higher prices, because if you are hosting United, Chelsea, Liverpool, City and so on, that's, you're able to charge higher prices than if it's, oh, we've got Middlesbrough versus Cardiff this weekend. You try selling that to a hospitality partner, you know, for a box. That's a tough gig. If you've got United coming in, the boxes sell themselves and use up the prices.
So it's a simple case of people actually just wanting to finish whatever's been started, so they can figure out if they've been relegated or not been relegated, or been promoted and not been promoted. And it's, there's nothing to do with, like, there's extra money coming in for finish the season, apart from obviously end of season prize money. Because that's what I can't rectify. Yes, I understand the fairness side of things, and you know, probably if I look deep enough into my heart, somewhere there's 1% of it which might think that Liverpool could win the league this year. Maybe it's probably like, what, 20% chance they could win the league this year, or some in that sort of ballpark. Maybe they deserve an opportunity to win that. But fundamentally, if it was just about getting games going again, surely just get the games going again. It shouldn't matter what season.
It shouldn't. But the financial consequences for those clubs that are relegated or promoted or not relegated and promoted are horrendous. Now, I think if they do decide to close the leagues now, what they will probably come up with is some sort of fudge solution, so that next season's Premier League consists of 22 clubs, and you bring up both Leeds and West Brom, and you'll bring up four clubs from the from League One to the Championship and so on, and what we'll have is, you know, four or five clubs being relegated next season as well. So it would be an incredibly exciting bun fight.
So next season we're going to finish it in less time with more clubs.
Yeah, well, what they'll
High
do
five.
Is Carabao Cup, you'll bin that. No, okay. Nobody's interested in it anyway. Yeah, and it's going. Yeah, I can assure you, it's on the list for getting the boot. The big clubs have been pushing for that.
Pep will be devastated.
That's right. FA Cup replays will be binned. You know, for all rounds for next season.
Yeah.
The midwinter break, clearly that will go. And in terms of international friendlies, you cut out two of those weekends, and all of a sudden you can get these fixtures in just. And you might have to extend the season to the end of May, the middle of June, but you'll probably manage it. If you think about it, I watched a side that's played, you know, most of the last decade in the Championship. Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday, Saturday, Tuesday was something you got used to. The problem you've got in the Premier League is that if you do qualify for the Europa League and the Champions League, you're already doing that Saturday, Tuesday or Saturday, Thursday routine. And that's when the problems arise. There are too many fixtures already, and you trying to squeeze them into a shorter period of time is going to involve an element of creativity. It could be that the Champions League next year goes to the knockout round is one match instead of two.
That'd be interesting. So you, just like the FA Cup, you get drawn first out of the hat is at home, second team out of the way is away, and it's a one-legger. That'd be amazing. Yeah, that would be fantastic.
All the winners of the league get automatic home matches in the round of 16.
Yeah, that's good.
So
yeah,
I think there are solutions. Whether you get into the power struggle between UEFA versus the Bundesliga versus the Premier League versus La Liga, because they've all got their fingers in different pies.
Yeah, versus TV money, who go, actually, we've paid for X number of Champions League games, and I honestly think the TV companies and the refund or possible refund back to them is one of the reasons why every Friday's meeting they're not discussing cancelling the league. I think there's probably some sort of clause somewhere where they said, we tried everything to make sure we could play them before we cancelled it. Therefore, you still owe us the money. Because I think if they discussed it at the first meeting, it'd be minuted, and they'd be like, well, you was instantly talking about scrapping it. Whereas if they go 5 or 6 weeks and it's not even on the agenda, by the time it does get brought up, I think there's a massive big dance going on me at the moment. That's just trying to make sure we don't have to pay anything back to Sky and BT Sport and all the rest of the world ones.
Yeah, we're talking, you know, £700-800 million to the TV companies. So, you know, even if you divide that between 20 clubs, that's a hell of a big rebate at a time when they've got no cash coming in anyway.
Yeah.
How can they repay when they've got no money?
How many clubs have got literally, Premier League clubs, have got literally nothing coming in? Is there a few, do you think?
I think if you take the bottom half of that division, yeah, because you know, who's buying merchandise?
Yeah.
You can't do hospitality. Where else? Some clubs will have commercial deals where their commercial partners are paying instalments, but that's not guaranteed. We've seen West Ham's shirt sleeve sponsor go into administration, so therefore West Ham aren't getting that money anymore, and expect that to be the case. If I was a finance director and I'm looking at my list of bills to pay for a sponsor, football club wouldn't be at the top of my pile. It'll be, you know, I've got people screaming for money, people who I'm dealing with on a day-by-day basis. Football clubs, nobody's got any sympathy for them, so you know, they ain't going to get paid.
Yeah, absolutely. In the middle of all this pandemic that's been going off, there's been the rumoured takeover of Newcastle United from one hated and despised owner who divested the club at every single opportunity and plastered Sports Direct all over it, to a possible Saudi royal family who might just be the richest people that have ever walked the face of the earth. Should Newcastle fans be getting excited, do you think?
I think they're getting excited in the sense that it does look as if Ashley's reign is finally coming to an end. And I've done quite a lot of work with the Newcastle TV and radio shows and papers and so on. What's different about this one is that we've actually got some documentation at Company's House from one of Ashley's companies and what he's actually done. And this is where it starts to get really weird. He is lending Amanda Staveley the money to buy her 10% of the club. So it looks like it's going to be 80% coming from the Saudi Arabian PIF fund, 10% from two guys known as the Rubin brothers, who are classic rags to riches, playboy. You know, they've got the yacht, they've got the flats in Monaco, they've got the helicopters. How else can you impress your mates? We go and buy a Premier League football club, and then when they're hosting United in Liverpool and Chelsea, you can invite your mates to the director's box and show off what a clever boy you are. So they're having 10%. Staveley's having 10%, but she's not got the cash. So Ashley has lent her the money. I think what the Saudis have said to Staveley, if you are serious that this is a good investment, show us your money. Buy some of the club yourself and we'll go along with you.
Wow.
So I do think it's a goer. My understanding is, yes, they have more zeros after their bank balance than you and I could. We just get lost trying to work out the billions and squillions. But they're going to be restrained by financial fair play.
That was my next question, actually.
Yeah. Well, financial fair play was designed not to stop City and Chelsea and PSG. It was to stop the creation of another City or PSG.
Such as Newcastle right now.
Yeah. Mike Ashley, for all his faults, has left Newcastle from an FFP point of view in a really strong position, because you're allowed to lose £105 million over 3 years. Well, they've been making profits, so actually, whoever buys the club is inheriting a very strong financial fair play position. So they won't be able to compete at the very top tier, but they'll certainly be in a position to be at the top of the other 14, if you know what I mean. And we've seen that if you buy the right players and you've got the right manager, you look at Leicester, Wolves, Sheffield United.
Absolutely,
it can be done, especially when some of the big six clubs are in a period of retrenchment, you know, reorganisation, whatever you want to call it. That there's a lack of continuity at United, Spurs, and Arsenal.
They should sign Pogba, and then they could have Pog on the Tyne. I'll get me coat. That was awful.
That was a gem.
That was my question was, is it possible for us to see Newcastle as a potential top six team? I think Manchester City took 3 years before their first bit of silverware from the Abu Dhabi takeover. Chelsea was a little bit quicker. I think it might have been two seasons from Abramovich going until they got Mourinho and then they won the title. Obviously, it's a little bit of a different landscape at the moment, but I think certainly top half and top six could be feasibly done by Newcastle with a couple of marquee signings and just running the club a little bit better than it previously has been, I think. It's going to be an interesting time to see what they go on and do. I know that your book discusses player wages, even though I've not read it. Alexis Sanchez, does he represent a massive drama for United at the moment and potentially over the course of the summer?
Yeah, in the sense that it's going to frustrate fans that he's not going to walk away from that contract. And if I was Alexis Sanchez, I wouldn't do it either. You know, why should he? He came to the club in good faith. United offered him more money than City in terms of wages. It's up to United to honour their side of the deal. You know, United also signed Marcus Rashford. And yeah, they could now sell him for, you know, what, $150 million, even in a deflated transfer market, because he's young as well as really good. So, you know, it's always a gamble when you sign players. I think United's recruitment, looking at it as a from outside, has been hit and miss over the course of the past 4 or 5 years, ever since Fergie retired. And as much as I know we're exactly where you're coming from in terms of the Glazers, they've backed all of the managers since Sir Alex retired in the transfer market in terms of the quantity of money. It's just the quality of the signings which has let you down.
Yeah, I think they certainly have put the money up. There's no way to deny that. I think sometimes the strategy of where, how and where that money's been spent hasn't quite been, to coin a Gary Neville phrase, the best in class. I think it's been quite a scattergun approach. I think it's been, oh, shiny thing, more than that's exactly what we need. I know Jose was limited in his final window. Maybe that was deliberate. He didn't want to keep hold of Pogba and Shaw and possibly a couple of others. Tony Marshall might have been one. He wanted to move all of those on, and the board apparently resisted that and chose against his wishes, and then wouldn't give him the money for a centre-half, and that's supposedly where it started to unravel quite badly for him. So do I like the idea of Ed Woodward meddling in football matters? Not at all. I think this is where a director of football would come in and actually make a massive difference for United. It seems like recruitment has changed, though. The acquisition of Dan James alone tells me that's a difference of focus. Wan-Bissaka, maybe not Maguire so much, but Bruno Fernandes, we got that done fairly efficiently, I would say. Igalo, we all thought was a case of, you know, someone's agent shared an agent, you know, Solskjaer shared an agent with him, and that was the only reason we signed him, but he's been fantastic. So I do think there's a definite change of focus for Manchester United. I think that we should probably wrap it up there, if that's all right with you.
Yeah, sounds bound.
Give us a reason to, well, for me to read it, but for everyone else to go out and buy it. Why do we need to be checking out your book?
Well, if you've got any interest in the lunacy of football, if you want to understand why we've got football clubs who are being sponsored by taxi companies that own no taxis, if you want to find out why clubs are paying players' mothers 700 grand a year to be an academy scout because it doesn't count for FFP, if you want to understand how to value a football club and also how much it costs to watch England in the 1966 World Cup compared to how much it would cost you to see them win it in Qatar, it's all that's in the book.
I'm sure I could take a good stab at that last one. Probably not a lot and far too much.
That's, you got it nailed.
All right, Kieran, thank you very much. I will leave a link to in the description to check out his book and his podcast. But go give him a follow on Twitter as well, which is at The Price of Football. And I guess I will see you guys in the next one. But Kieran, thank you very much for joining me. This has been a pleasure. I'll chat to you soon.
Thanks for the invite.
Cheers.